Ever hear about the 21-year-old who snagged a $300 million Pentagon contract and then, well, tried to pull a fast one? It sounds like a movie plot, right?
It really does.
Well, today we're diving deep into the real legal drama behind that story, the case of Ephraim Diverioli v. United States, decided by the 11th Circuit back in 2015.
Absolutely. And while, the movie War Dogs definitely put a Hollywood spin on it, what's truly significant for law students listening are the crucial legal principles at play here.
Right.
We're talking about the real uphill battle of challenging a guilty plea after the fact, and the practical realities of trying to use certain defenses when you're facing serious fraud allegations.
Exactly. So let's forget the movie magic for a second. Our mission today is to unpack the critical legal lessons, the ones for future lawyers, buried within this really fascinating case. Okay, so let's get into it. Who was this Ephraim Diverioli, and how did he end up in such a mess?
So Ephraim Diverioli was incredibly young, president of an arms dealing company called AEY Inc. Back in 2007, AEY actually managed to secure this massive $298 million contract with the U.S. Army.
Wow.
Yeah, to supply ammunition for the war effort in Afghanistan.
Nearly $300 million. That's just staggering. And I remember reading there was a pretty critical condition attached to this huge deal, right?
There was, yeah. And this is absolutely key. The contract explicitly stipulated no Chinese-made ammunition could be supplied, period, directly
No.
or indirectly.
Okay.
And this wasn't just like a minor preference. It was a firm requirement based on a specific federal regulation. It's part of the government's procurement rules, specifically restricting certain military supplies from China.
Right, so crystal clear, no Chinese ammo. So what went wrong?
Well, the problem was Diverioli's supplier in Albania ended up providing ammunition that had, in fact, originated in China.
Ah.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Instead of, stopping finding a compliant source, Diverioli allegedly decided to try and, well, cover up where the ammo came from.
Cover it up. We're talking millions of rounds of ammunition. That's not exactly easy to
No,
hide.
exactly. The alleged cover-up involved physically repackaging the ammunition to remove any markings indicating it was Chinese.
Wow.
And on top of that, Diverioli and AEY submitted official compliance certificates that falsely claimed the ammunition was actually sourced from Albania.
That's pretty deliberate deception.
Ugh.
And it didn't end there, did it? I seem to recall a specific warning being issued somewhere along the line.
You're absolutely right. Diverioli actually asked the U.S. Department of State about the legality of supplying this specific ammo.
He asked them.
Yeah. And they explicitly warned him. They said, look, purchasing and supplying Chinese-made ammo is illegal and would need a specific presidential authorization to be okay.
Presidential authorization,
Yep.
just like a nod from someone.
Exactly. But despite this really clear warning, Diverioli allegedly went ahead, fulfilled the contract using these falsified documents anyway.
He was told point blank it was illegal and did it anyway. That sounds like textbook what not to do. So, how did the government figure this out?
Well, for fraud was eventually uncovered, leading to federal charges against Diverioli and AEY for conspiracy and fraud. And ultimately, Diverioli entered into a plea agreement. He pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy.
Okay, and what was the initial sentence from that plea?
He got 48 months, so 4 years, in federal prison. Plus, he was ordered to pay a significant fine and restitution.
Right.
But that wasn't the end of the story, because Diverioli later came back and argued he'd received ineffective assistance of counsel during that whole plea process.
Oh, okay.
He claimed his lawyer's advice was bad, basically, and that's what led to this appeal in the 11th Circuit that we're looking at.
Right. So the core of this appeal wasn't really about whether he did the fraud. He'd already pleaded guilty to that. It was about whether that guilty plea should be tossed out because his lawyer messed up. So, okay, let's dive into those legal arguments. What was Diverioli's main point on appeal?
His central argument was exactly that: ineffective assistance of counsel. He claimed his lawyer gave him seriously flawed advice about the potential sentence he was looking at if he went to trial instead of taking the plea deal.
Okay. And what's the legal standard for proving ineffective assistance? I remember it being a pretty high bar.
It is, yeah, it's a significant hurdle. The Supreme Court set out a two-part test in Strickland v. Washington. First, the defendant has to show their lawyer's performance was objectively unreasonable, like fell below what any reasonably competent attorney would do.
Right.
Second, they have to show that this bad performance actually prejudiced their defense, meaning there's a reasonable probability that if the lawyer hadn't messed up, the outcome would have been different.
Okay. Performance and prejudice.
Exactly. And then, specifically for guilty pleas, the court added another layer in Hill v. Lockhart. The defendant has to show that if they had received proper advice, they actually would have chosen to go to trial instead of pleading guilty.
So they have to show the bad advice was the reason they took the plea.
Precisely. It's not enough that the advice was bad. It has to be the deciding factor.
Okay, so Deverly had to argue his lawyer not only messed up the advice, but also that he would have rolled the dice at trial if he'd known the real potential sentence. What exactly did he say his lawyer got wrong?
Deverly claimed his lawyer way overestimated the sentence he might get if convicted at trial. The lawyer apparently told him he could be looking at something like 14 to 17 years.
Oh.
Yeah. Deverly argued that if his lawyer had correctly told him the likely guideline range, which he believed was closer to 5 to 7 years, he would have rejected the plea and taken his chances.
That's a big difference, 14-17 versus 5-7. So did the 11th Circuit agree his lawyer's estimate was wrong?
Well, here's what's really interesting. The 11th Circuit assumed, just for the sake of argument, that the lawyer's sentencing estimate was a miscalculation. They basically said, okay, let's pretend that counts as deficient performance under Strickland's first prong. However, and this is the key part that wasn't enough for Deverly to win. The court ultimately said he couldn't satisfy the second prong.
Yeah.
Prejudice.
So even if his lawyer gave him bad sentencing advice, the court didn't think it ultimately mattered. Why not?
Their reasoning on prejudice really focused on the defenses Deverly claimed he would have used at trial. The court looked at them and basically said they were meritless. In their view, even with perfect legal advice about sentencing, the evidence against him was so overwhelming, he would have been convicted anyway. So let's look at those defenses. The first was what the court called the literal truth defense.
The literal truth defense. Okay, that sounds interesting. What was that argument?
He argued the compliance certificates were technically true because Albania was the immediate supplier, even if the ammo itself came from China originally.
Trying to be clever with wording.
Yeah, relying on a really narrow, literal reading. Basically saying, hey, the paperwork said Albania, so I didn't technically lie.
But didn't the government have proof he knew it was Chinese ammo?
Oh, absolutely. The court pointed to just a mountain of evidence that blew this defense out of the water. Emails, photos clearly showing Chinese markings on the ammo.
Right.
Even discussions between Deverly and others about how to hide those markings during repackaging. So given all that proof, he knew the real origin. The 11th Circuit flatly called this defense patently frivolous.
Patently frivolous. Yeah, that's pretty damning legal language. Okay, so that one didn't fly. What was the other defense he said he would have used?
His second idea was the public authority defense. Basically, he claimed that a U.S. embassy official over in Albania had somehow given tacit approval or maybe even encouraged his plan to supply the Chinese ammo.
So he was saying he thought he kind of had a wink-wink nudge-nudge from a U.S. official?
That was the gist, yeah. But the court found zero credible evidence in the record to back this up.
Nothing at all.
Nothing credible. And more importantly, they pointed straight back to that explicit warning Deverly himself got from the State Department.
The one saying it was illegal without presidential approval.
Exactly. They reminded him that this kind of deal needed the president's okay, something way above the pay grade of some embassy official. The evidence just didn't support the idea that any authorized government person approved what he was doing.
So the court's bottom line was basically, look, even if your lawyer's sentencing math was off, your defenses were so terrible, you were almost certainly going down at trial anyway, so taking the plea deal didn't actually hurt you. You weren't prejudiced.
That sums it up perfectly.
Yeah.
The 11th Circuit kept highlighting the sheer volume and strength of the evidence, the fake documents, his own admissions about the ammo's origin, the fact there were 85 fraudulent shipments.
85, wow.
Yeah. And they also noted the huge benefit he got from the plea deal getting 83 other felony counts dismissed.
Right, that's significant.
So given the mountain of evidence and the, frankly, useless defenses, the court decided that accepting the plea, even with potentially flawed sentencing advice, was still a rational, probably beneficial choice for Deverly in those circumstances.
Okay, so let's boil this down for the law students listening. What are the absolute key lessons you should take away from the Deverly case?
Well, there are several really critical ones. First, this case just powerfully shows how incredibly difficult it is to challenge a guilty plea once you've entered it.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just say, my lawyer made a mistake. You have to prove both that the lawyer's performance was objectively bad and that there's a reasonable chance you would have gone to trial and maybe gotten a better outcome with good advice.
Yeah.
That two-part test is tough.
That Strickland standard, especially applied to pleas under Hill, seems like a really fundamental concept to get. What's another big takeaway?
This case is also just a stark reminder about the high evidence bar for affirmative defenses. Mm-hmm. Things like literal truth or public authority. They aren't just clever arguments you can toss out there.
Right.
They need real, solid, factual support in the evidence. If all the proof points the other way, like Deveroli's emails and the State Department warning did, those defenses are going to crash and burn. The court's patently frivolous label says it all.
Yeah, you need the facts to back it up. And finally, what about the government contracts angle? Seems like an important lesson there, too, especially for anyone interested in procurement law.
Absolutely. Deveroli really underscores how incredibly strict government contracts are, particularly in sensitive areas like defense. Misrepresenting things, not disclosing key info, trying to skirt the rules like the ban on Chinese ammo here, it can lead to incredibly severe legal and financial trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The government expects you to follow the contract terms to the letter. Any attempt to deceive them is super risky and, as Deveroli found out, potentially criminal. Compliance isn't optional. It's non-negotiable.
So while Ephraim Deveroli's story is definitely wild, almost unbelievable enough for Hollywood, it actually gives us some very serious, sobering legal lessons. His failed attempt to undo his plea really hammers home that, you know, ignorance of the law is no excuse, but actively ignoring it, especially when dealing with the federal government and huge contracts, has major consequences. Doesn't matter if they make a movie about you later.
That's exactly right. And, you know, this case kind of leaves us with some important questions to think about. When the evidence against a client is just overwhelming and a plea deal offers a way better sentence than going to trial, what is effective counsel then?
Yeah.
Is it just about getting the sentencing prediction perfect? Or is it maybe also about the tough job of guiding a client towards the most rational choice, given the harsh reality of the evidence and how weak the defenses are?
That's a good point. Where is that line between fighting hard and strategically accepting the likely outcome?
It's complex, right? There are real ethical and practical things to consider there. And this case, in its own way, really brings those issues to the surface for all of us thinking about legal practice.